This is Audible.
Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Operation Medusa by Glenn Stewart, narrated by Eric Michael Summerer. Chapter 1. Midori System. 0600, August 1st, 2737, Earth Standard Meridian Date, Time. DSC-062, Normandy.
Alert! Alert! All hands to battle stations! All hands to battle stations! System Command has identified multiple Alcubierre emergencies! All hands to battle stations!
Vice Commodore Russell Rokos spared approximately 3/4 of a second to look despairingly at the freshly warmed-up, homemade scone sitting on his desk. A gift from his currently almost 50 light-years away wife. Getting homemade baked treats to one of Castle Federation's carriers deployed on the front took a minor miracle and a lot of determination. But his wife had somehow made it happen. Being a senior police officer on the capital planet probably helped, but it wasn't easy. So, of course, the Terran Commonwealth would choose this particular moment to attack, forcing him to waste a full quarter of her gift. The broad-shouldered starfighter officer, however, was a professional and ran through that entire thought process in moments. Then he tore a chunk of the scone off and stuffed it in his mouth as he rose and began to run toward Normandy's flight deck. The 192 starfighters aboard were his responsibility now. The almost 600 crew who flew those ships were far more important than his ruined snack. As he ran, he linked his neural implant up to the carrier's main tactical feed, downloading the update that Midori System Command was feeding the ships of Task Force Midori. He swallowed his piece of scone in horror. Midori had been the scene of no less than 4 battles so far in the seesawing war between the Castle Federation and her allies and the Terran Commonwealth. Most of those battles had been relatively even, with attempts by the Terran commander, Marshal James Calvin Walkingstick, to force the Alliance to defend the refueling infrastructure in Midori and allow him to destroy ships. Ships the Commonwealth could replace far more easily than the Alliance could. Over 20 Alcubierre Drive starships, an entire star system's GDP's worth of warships, had died defending this system, a slow grind that weakened the Alliance more than Walkingstick's fleet. This was not that kind of attack.
"Keg?" The mental voice of Captain Carl Herrera cut into Russell's thoughts. "Are you ready to launch?"
20 seconds from flight deck," he responded crisply.
"Two squadrons of Alpha Flight Group are already out at the CSP. 2 more are in the tubes with crews aboard. None of the bombers are up, and everything is going to take at least 3 minutes to man," he reeled off. "Standard launch cycle. We'll be live and in space in 5 minutes, no more."
"Even the bombers?" Herrera asked.
One of Russell's 4 48-ship wings had been swapped from starfighters to bombers barely 2 months before. The Vulture-type ships and their new torpedoes were a boost to his fighter group's capability, but few of his compatriots trusted them yet.
"Even the bombers," Russell confirmed. "We'll be ready."
He felt Herrera shake his head over the mental channel.
"It won't be enough,"
the captain told him, the channel through their neural implants utterly secure and with no chance of eavesdroppers.
"I can fight this battle in my head. I just don't see a way out."
Russell said nothing. Task Force Midori had 8 ships from 3 of the Alliance's major powers, a force that made the Task Force designation a severe underestimation. The Terran fleet was being led by 8 battleships, and another 10 carriers and cruisers came behind them. Midori was doomed. They had time. Not a lot of it, but time. The massive Terran fleet was only accelerating in from the outer system at 200 gravities, which gave the Alliance fleet several hours to put together their response. Like the rest of the starfighter CAGs, Russell's place in that conversation was aboard his starfighter. The speed and power of the neural implants all of the Alliance military personnel were equipped with meant that he might as well have been in a room with the starship captains and flag officers, though.
"They brought their A-game,"
Vice Admiral the Elector Parth Rothenberg noted to his subordinates. The dark-skinned man was an Elector of the Coraline Imperium, part of their pseudo-military aristocracy, and the man in command of Task Force Midori.
"All 8 battleships are Saint-class," he continued. That's more saints than we thought Walking Stick had left after his losses. It's easily half of the Commonwealth's surviving strength of the class until their next wave of new construction finishes. The rest is no better. 4 Hercules-class battlecruisers of the same vintage, 4 Volcano-class carriers, and 2 Lexingtons. Everything except the Lexingtons were relatively new units, built in the last 10 years, and easily the equal of a Victory-class carrier like Normandy. We are outnumbered 2-1. The cubage disadvantage is about as severe. We have Summerlands and Genghis Khan, but most of our ships are smaller. The 2 ships he had named were the heavyweights of the task force, modern, top-of-the-line Castle Federation warships, bigger than anything the Commonwealth had yet built. Alongside Normandy, the Federation had sent 3 ships to Midori. Not to be outdone, the Coraline Imperium had also sent 3, 1 modern carrier, Righteous Fire, and 2 Ramses-class battlecruisers. A single modern battlecruiser from the Star Kingdom of Phoenix and a Renaissance trade factor-built carrier belonging to the Midori Self-Defense Force made up the rest of Rothenburg's fleet. They haven't summoned us to surrender. They know we won't, Rothenburg concluded dryly. We have no choice but to assume they have bombers as well, so our vultures won't be a surprise.
What about the fixed defenses? Colonel Genevieve LaCroix, the CAG aboard the Phoenix warship Dauntless, asked. The MSDF has another 1,000 fighters to back up our strength.
And I intend to use them, Rothenburg replied, his virtual avatar glancing at the still silent form of Admiral Paris Kennedy, the woman in charge of the MSDF. This was her system, after all, even if Rothenburg commanded the Alliance Task Force. But they aren't enough to turn the tide against 8 battleships. Kennedy finally stirred.
No, they're not, she concluded. Admiral, do you honestly expect to be able to save Midori?
The mental conference was silent for several long seconds. No. The words were tombstones. But I see no other option but to take a leaf from the Fox's book. A head-on assault with everything we have. Target the battleships. The Commonwealth commander is almost certainly aboard one of them. Russell kept his laugh out of the channel. The Stellar Fox, his old captain, had once taken a single carrier against a Commonwealth battlegroup. Of course, he'd emerged from FTL inside the battlegroup's formation, accidentally rammed a battleship, and lost his carrier in the end. But he'd won.
But regardless of whether the Terran Admiral dies in your strike, they will complete their mission plan, Kennedy said softly. This task force will be destroyed. Midori will fall.
No one had the courage to confirm what she'd said.
That's what I thought, she continued. Ladies, gentlemen, officers, under Section 7 of the Alliance Treaty of Mutual Defense, I am assuming command of all forces in this system.
As the ranking officer of the local government, she had that authority, though the Midorians had generally been willing to let Alliance officers lead the defense.
I have only one order, Kennedy continued into the silence. You will withdraw. Midori's Hope will withdraw with you. I will have the President transferred aboard immediately.
Kennedy herself was aboard a station in orbit. For some reason, Russell didn't expect her to be leaving aboard the carrier she was sending away. Ma'am, I served with the Fox, he found himself objecting. We all know what he said when he went to Tranquility in a shattered carrier. There may yet come a day when the Federation must break its word to its allies from necessity. Today is not that day. The woman who spoke for Midori chuckled sadly and shook her head.
No, it is not, she agreed. I am ordering you to withdraw, Vice Commodore Rokos. We cannot win this battle, and your warships will better serve my world defeating the Commonwealth tomorrow than dying pointlessly today.
There was a long silence. It probably wasn't more than 10 seconds, but given the speed a neural implant conference usually moved at, it may as well have lasted an hour. Then Admiral Rothenburg bowed his aristocratic head in agreement.
You have that authority, he told her. We will acquiesce. He smiled grimly. I will not, however, withdraw from this system without bleeding the Commonwealth first. Request permission to launch a long-range bomber strike? We won't need the MSDF fighters for that, he continued. Between my Righteous Fire and the Federation carriers, we have three wings of vultures, 136 bombers. Kennedy nodded once.
I will have no vain hopes launched on our account, she told the assembled officers. No grand sacrifices. Bleed the Terrans, yes. But not yourselves, I insist.
This will be our first major battle where both sides have bombers, Commodore Victor Ossolinch, the senior Federation CAG, noted. They'll know what our attack pattern means if we keep the range open.
Let them, Rothenberg said grimly. They'll send their fighters out to intercept, and we'll lose people, but less than if we go head-on and throw the entire fighter strike into the teeth of their formation. 1,000,000 kilometers, Kags, he ordered. You won't be in range of your starfighter missiles, so use them to defend the bombers. And let me be clear, Rothenberg concluded. Any pilot who closes within 1,000,000 kilometers of the Terrans and isn't blown to pieces by them will be busted back to ground crew. Am I clear?
Yes, sir,
Russell chorused with the rest of the pilots. Orders like that were why, if Rothenberg had given the command, every starfighter in his command would have gone straight down the Commonwealth fleet's throat.
We will deploy our starfighters as well, Kennedy informed them. They will close for a standard strike before rendezvousing with your fleet.
We will take as many of them with us as we can fit aboard, the Imperial Admiral promised.
Russell shivered. The Midori Self-Defense Force flew an upgraded version of the Federation's last-generation Cobra starfighter. The Alliance ships could easily take on the 3,000 or so crew aboard those ships, but stacking another 1,000 starfighters on their decks would be hell. Unfortunately, if the MSDF starfighters pressed a close attack on the Commonwealth formation, there wouldn't be very many of them left to cram aboard the Alliance ships. Russell blinked his attention away from the meeting to the immediate task. A Victory-class carrier carried 4 fighter wings of 6 squadrons apiece, a total of 192 starfighters and 575 other lives dependent on him.
All right, people, he snapped over the fighter group channel. Orders from on high. Starships are going to make a run for it. We've got the geometry, and the Terrans can't catch them.
We're just leaving?
We are leaving, Russell confirmed. Orders from the Midorians themselves. We can't hold, and the locals have forbidden us to be stupid.
That said, we're not going to let the Terrans just waltz in and take over, he told his people.
Form up on the vultures. We're making a 1 mega-click pass and dumping every torpedo this task force has down their throat. Wing Commander Reyes, are your people ready to serve me some fried battleship?
Hell yes, Vice Commodore,
his bomber commander replied instantly.
Would you like them over easy?
Russell chuckled.
I'll settle for in pieces, Wing Com, he told her. Coordinate with the other bomber wings. We're going to get one shot at medium range, and then we are going to run like scared rabbits who saw the hound. You get me?
I get you, sir.
And the rest of you?
Russell turned his digital attention to his other 3 wing commanders, 18 flight commanders, and 500 starfighter pilots, gunners, and engineers.
The Terrans aren't stupid, he reminded them, and they have bombers of their own.
In fact, they'd had them first, but the Alliance had stolen the plans. They'd done a better job of rolling them out than the Terrans had, too, completely destroying any advantage the Commonwealth would have received from the deadly little ships.
We don't know who's in charge over there, but Walking Stick isn't going to roll out 16 of his most modern toys under command of an idiot. They're going to realize what we're doing as soon as they run our vectors, which means we are going to have every starfighter an entire fleet carries coming our way. We're not closing to our range of the enemy capital ships, which means our job is to cover the bombers. With the MSDF along for the ride, we have more fighters than they do. Let's demonstrate why that was a bad plan on their part, shall we?
Chapter 2. Midori System. 10:00, August 1st, 2737, Earth Standard Meridian Date Time. Task Force Midori Fighter Strike.
Here they come,
Russell's gunner, Jan Hu, observed softly as the tactical feed showed the Commonwealth fleet finally separating into multiple visible components. It had taken the Terrans a surprisingly long time to move their starfighters out, though the Vice Commodore supposed it wasn't going to make too much difference. Checking the vectors, the Terran ships would still intercept the Alliance formation 2 million kilometers clear of their starships, and launch missiles several minutes before that.
Let's make things more confusing for them, he observed. Commodore Ozalinch, I recommend the Spartacus Protocol.
Russell wasn't entirely certain of the source of the name. His understanding was that it was one of the VR dramas that the Commodore liked, Ozalinch being a fan of the Tau Ceti Silver Road era, when the 23rd century VR producers in Tau Ceti had spent much of their time remaking the 20th century's classic movies. For, oh, the ninth time.
I agree,
the Commodore replied instantly.
Make it happen, Rokos.
Russell pinged the op plan in the data net, linking the 2,000-plus starfighters, feeding the instructions that most of them had been briefed on. The final build of the Vulture looked different from the Terran longbow Russell had helped steal the plans for, but its core design and function were very similar. What it had that the longbow lacked, however, was the same electronic warfare suite that had made the Castle Federation's Falcon starfighter the terror of the Commonwealth Navy. The Arrow B-type fighters, an upgrade from the Imperium's original 7th-generation starfighter, had a functionally identical electronic warfare suite installed, as did the Star Kingdom of Phoenix's Templars. The Midorian King Cobra-type fighters weren't as capable, but their EW was easily a match of that of the Terran's 7th-generation Katana-type starfighter. Which meant that when Task Force Midori's starfighters activated the Spartacus Protocol, the starfighter strike went from being roughly 10% bombers to appearing to be all bombers. And in Rokos's own contribution, learned from the Stellar Fox, all of their bombers were pretending to be starfighters. Starfighters that were pretending to be bombers.
I only make it 900 katanas, Hu noted. Shouldn't they have over 1,000 starfighters?
They should, Russell confirmed to his gunner. That means the other 150 are longbows and they're holding them back.
For the Alliance, the bombers were the key to this strike. For the Terrans, they were entirely unnecessary.
36 minutes to fighter missile range, Hu reported. 42 to positron lance range, 51 to closest approach to the Terran starships.
Make sure the tactical net is running cleanly and in random swap mode, Russell ordered. And if our Terran friends have had an unexpected moment of incompetence and aren't running in random swap mode, feel free to designate their command ships for everyone else.
Hu laughed bitterly.
Not a chance, he replied. These guys know their business.
Russell nodded. Like Admiral Rothenberg had said, the Commonwealth had sent their A-game. Terran biases meant they hadn't brought enough starfighters, and they were going to pay for that mistake. But there was no way the Alliance could hold Midori. All they could do was hurt Walking Stick's people. The human brain interacted with neural implants in odd ways. Some people interpreted the data from the implant faster or more easily than others. Some simply processed more data at once. Some could process less data simultaneously, but did so faster than others. All of that capacity was lumped under the generic term of bandwidth. And to be a starfighter pilot, gunner, or flight engineer, a recruit had to be in the top half percentile of the human race for it. Vice Commodore Russell Rokos was in the top half of the people who could fly starfighters, but as the two forces rushed together, even his ability to process the data his Falcon C command ship was throwing at him was strained. He was tracking the vectors and targeting lines of 900 Terran starfighters, watching to see if there was any change in their pattern that suggested they'd identified the bombers. He was tracking the vectors and lines of fire of all almost 200 of his own starfighters, plus surveying the electronic warfare efforts being coordinated by his subordinates. On top of that, he was flying his own starfighter, keeping it constantly evading in three dimensions as he accelerated toward a point 1 million kilometers away from the Terran starships at 500 gravities. his own starfighter's contribution to the electronic warfare chorus singing across the Alliance formation was being handled by his gunner, even as Hu was also making sure the Falcon's missiles were being constantly updated with potential targets, and the Lance was ready to go the moment they were in range. All of the data flowed from sensors and computers in the Falcon's computers, run through the artificial intelligences that interfaced with human minds, and presented itself to his brain in ways he could understand. Which meant his reaction time was far beyond human normal. Their computers could fight the vessel without him, but the humans in the loop increased its survivability and lethality 100-fold. The instant the two forces crossed the line in space where the geometry meant their missiles could reach each other, space lit up with thousands of tiny fireflies. Of the almost 3,000 starfighters in space, 2/3 launched 4 missiles apiece. The Midorian King Cobras and the Phoenix's Templars only launched 3 each, undermining the illusion that they were bombers, and the bombers and the Coraline Arrows held back 2 missiles each, since those ships carried 6 launchers. There were still over 10,000 missiles in space, their antimatter drives filling the area around the 2 fighter groups with radiation, light, and drives. Under the cover of that distraction, the Alliance force split in 2. The MSDF fighters continued their charge, holding the rest of their missiles back to launch into the teeth of the Terran fleet. The Alliance fighters turned away, their engines now straining to begin the long, arcing turn that would eventually intercept their motherships. Their launchers continued to cycle, emptying the 3-round magazines in under 30 seconds. Lasers and positron lances lit up around Russell as he danced his starfighter through the chaotic environment. By now, the Terrans had probably identified the bombers, but their formation was still wide, the missile salvo spread out. It wasn't a great strategy for taking out the bombers, but it would make sure they killed at least some of the Alliance ships. Missiles began to explode, first in handfuls, as lucky extreme-range shots from the defensive lasers hit them, then in dozens, then in hundreds. It was becoming harder and harder to see anything clearly, but Russell watched the range and the status of his own people. There wasn't much he could do at this point, other than fly his fighter and make sure none of his crews strayed too far from the flight group's defensive umbrella. The cascade of fire swept toward them, reaching out for his people. But 900 starfighters could put only so many missiles into space against the defensive firepower of 2,000. Only a handful of missiles punched through the Alliance defenses. It was enough. Each missile that made it through killed a starfighter, and that tiny fraction of the original salvo was enough to kill over 100 of Russell's comrades by the time they reached lance range of the incoming starfighters. The subtle shift in formation had hopefully been missed by the Terrans, but it put the Star Kingdom of Phoenix's Templar starfighters in front of the bombers. Their heavy 60-kiloton-a-second positron lances were the only ones in the Alliance force that could match the katanas for range. 300 of the katanas survived to smash into LaCroix's Templars, and the Star Kingdom's pilots held their attention for those precious few seconds where no one else could engage. They got and held the Terran's attention, and paid for it. Dozens more Alliance starfighters died, but the katana's heavier lances could have shredded the Falcons and Arrows. Now the Arrows and Vultures salvoed their last missiles into the Commonwealth's teeth, followed by the massed positron lances of the rest of the flight group. Beams of pure antimatter ripped across the stars, and Russell focused his attention on staying alive. Then they were through, a scattered handful of Terran starfighters fleeing behind them. Their course would keep them well clear of any of the starships or defenses in the system. But they'd done enough. Russell could see the numbers in his head. 1/3 of their bombers and 1/4 of their fighters were gone. Barely a single squadron of Dauntless's Templars remained. The MSDF had gone mostly unscathed, something the Terrans would regret. But there was no way the Alliance fighter strike could take out the prepared formation waiting for them.
"We hold to the plan," Ozalinch ordered grimly. "All bombers, salvo torpedoes at the designated point. All Alliance fighters, get ready to turn for home."
Russell waited, watching as they rushed towards their closest approach. 105 surviving bombers lit up the stars in the middle of their formation. each of them firing 4 massive torpedoes at the Terran fleet.
"Turn and burn!" Ozalinch barked. "Break for the barn! Our part in this is over."
The sky lit up with fire as the torpedoes charged in, the MSDF starfighters hot on their heels. The gemblade torps were no faster than the lighter missiles the starfighters had been flinging at each other minutes before, but they burned longer and harder and came in at a higher velocity and had more powerful electronic warfare suites as well. The Saint-class battleships had been built to stand off massed starfighter salvos, however, and so had the Volcano carriers and Hercules battlecruisers. Missile defense lasers lit up the void, and defensive positron lances tore into both missiles and the closing fighters. Russell watched in silence, his own course carrying him farther away from the firestorm lighting up the Midori system behind him with each passing second.
"Sir," Hu said quietly, "we're detecting missile launches from the starships."
"Aimed at the Midorians?"
"Negative. At us,"
his gunner confirmed.
350-plus missiles. Apparently the Midorians aren't a high enough priority."
Russell shook his head. It was a rare commander with the nerve to assess an incoming fighter strike, calculate that he could handle it with his ship's defensive positron lances, and then launch missiles at the retreating enemy. He wasn't entirely surprised that this fleet had one.
"Still no sign of their bombers?" he asked.
"Negative."
The Vice Commodore grunted. The Terrans were probably holding them in reserve for the defensive platforms in orbit of the Midorian's planet.
"Any chance we're just going to leave them behind?" he asked.
They did have a pretty significant velocity away from the Terran fleet, after all.
"It's going to take them a while to catch us," Hu replied. "But they're going to. Probably 2 hours.
That was pushing the endurance envelope for even capital ship missiles, but it was still endurance the things had.
"Make sure everyone knows," Russell ordered. "Keep the EW up. If they fired one salvo, they'll fire more."
"And the Midorians?"
Russell shook his head, his attention focusing back on the suicide charge of the Midori Self-Defense Force.
"We'll wait for any of the starfighters that survive, but there's nothing we can do for them now," he admitted.
"I meant the planet,"
Hu said, his voice grim.
"There is even less we can do for them."
The Terrans launched over 3,000 missiles at the fleeing starfighters, 10 salvos chasing the Alliance formation through space. For the first few minutes, Russell ignored them completely, watching the explosions lighting up the star system around him. Hundreds of quantum entanglement comm-equipped probes were positioned around Midori, providing the Alliance fleet with a real-time view of everything going on. Right now, that view was depressing. As Task Force Midori withdrew toward the other side of the star system from the Terran fleet, they left behind the massive fleet base and refueling infrastructure the Alliance had spent the interwar years building and upgrading. That infrastructure and those supplies couldn't be left for the Commonwealth. Once the fleet was clear, pre-positioned missile warheads began to detonate, a sequence of 1 gigaton explosions marching their way through 40 years of construction and several trillion Federation stellars of investment. Brutal as that view was, the feat of the Terran fleet itself was worse. 1,000 King Cobra starfighters had flung themselves into the teeth of the Commonwealth formation, behind a wall of torpedoes and fighter missiles. Even with the Q-probes, it was hard to see what happened, but the Terrans had been confident enough to spend their missiles flinging them after Russell's formation. It turned out that hadn't been the smartest idea they'd had today. The torpedoes struck first, most dying before they reached their targets, but enough making it through that several of the battleships began to lurch out of formation, their engines and mass manipulators flickering from near-fatal hits. The starfighter missiles were more numerous but less capable, dying in their hundreds as they approached. None of them made it through the defensive fire, but every beam that fired at the missiles didn't target a starfighter. The final clash could only ever last seconds, with positron lance ranges measured in tens of thousands of kilometers and the closing velocity measured in fractions of light speed. The starfighters flashed into range and opened fire, beams of pure antimatter linking ships together. The starfighters got the worst of the exchange, dying like moths to a flame as they tore through the Terran formation. But they didn't die alone. Both damaged battleships disappeared, and one of their undamaged sisters joined them. A volcano lurched out of formation and then came apart. A battlecruiser twisted, damaged but still fighting. And then it was over. The scattered survivors of the fighter strike fleeing into the outer system, their courses already adjusting as they twisted to try and meet the Alliance Task Force. If they couldn't meet up with Task Force Midori before the starships left, their only hope would be surrender.
"That was better than I was afraid of," Hu murmured.
"I wasn't allowing myself to hope they'd get anyone," Russell agreed. His attention turned to the missiles coming after them in the long stern chase.
"Start scanning those missiles," he ordered. "We've got a lot of time to dial them in. This is about as clean a shot as we'll ever get at incoming fire. I refuse to lose anybody else today."
Chapter 3. Castle System. 1800, August 1st, 2737, Earth Standard Meridian, date, time. New Cardiff.
"What was the final count?"
Rear Admiral Kyle Roberts, commanding officer of the Alliance's Joint Strategic Options Command, asked his aide grimly.
"We've confirmed 3 of the Saints and 1 of the volcanoes taken out by the fighter strike. Another Saint badly damaged and a Hercules mission killed by the orbital defenses. Just over 800 katanas destroyed and 70 longbows."
Senior Fleet Commander Archie Sterling reeled off the numbers quickly. 6 months working for the still freshly minted Rear Admiral had given the portly bald reservist a new confidence in his ability to wrangle officers both senior and junior to him in the service of the Alliance. His massive red-haired boss nodded, looking out the window across New Cardiff, one of Castle's largest cities, and home to Castle Federation High Command.
"We've confirmed they only launched 100 bombers in the final strike?" he asked.
"As much as we can," Sterling said cautiously.
"Admiral Rothenberg detonated the Q-probes as he withdrew. We're running off what information Midori System Command sent us before they went dark. There's no switchboard station in the system. They used our net and the Imperials."
A quantum entanglement communicator was inherently a two-point system. The particles talked to each other. Nothing else. The solution had been obvious to engineers, if not necessarily the scientists who'd built the first QCOMs. One part of every entangled pair was kept in a single place, allowing everyone to link into the switchboard and be connected. Those switchboard stations talked to each other and were kept in orbit to minimize interference. They were also expensive and heavily defended, so a smaller system like Midori rarely had one of their own.
"Has EW Command locked down those pairs?" he asked.
Access into the Alliance's military QCOM network would be a huge bonus to an already devastating victory for the Commonwealth.
"All QCOM blocks known to be in Midori have been quarantined," Sterling confirmed.
Kyle nodded again, sighing and studying the city as he braced himself for the next question.
"How bad is it, Archie?" he asked.
"Phoenix lost almost the entirety of Dauntless's wing," Sterling told him. "The Imperials got off lightly, but we lost over 70 Vultures and 300 Falcons. No chance to retrieve life pods. Anyone who ejected
is now a Commonwealth prisoner," Kyle agreed.
There were worse fates, at least. The Commonwealth Navy's atrocities were grander things, the results of moments of passion in people who held the firepower to devastate worlds, not the slow cruelty of prisoner abuse.
"And the rest?"
"Task Force Midori picked up 117 King Cobra starfighters on their way out of the system. That wasn't even enough to refill Midori's Hope's fighter decks. They're falling back to join 7th Fleet."
Without replacement starfighters, TF Midori was well under capacity now. 7th Fleet could use the extra ships, especially if some of what JSOC had been working on came to fruition.
"We owe Kennedy," Kyle admitted. "Rothenberg would have stood and fought, would have been right to stand and fight, but he would have lost, and we didn't need to lose another 9 starships."
He rose, his implant linking into the screen over the window and darkening it to display the data he was asking for. The man the media called the Stellar Fox had spent 6 months stuck in this office, handed an impossible mission: find a way to win the war against the Terran Commonwealth. The display overlaid over the view of New Cardiff told the dark truth behind that. On one side, the holographic presentation of ships and starfighters lost by the Alliance. On the other, the estimated losses for the Commonwealth. 6 months. In 6 months, the Alliance had lost 26 capital ships. Each of those ships represented between 5 and 10,000 lives, 5% of a star system's GDP, and 4 years of construction time. Combined, those losses brought the Alliance's total ship strength down to barely 250 starships. Including today's losses, the Commonwealth had spent 33 capital ships to inflict those losses, roughly a fifth of the strength assigned to Marshal Walkingstick, leaving the Terran commander with an estimated 120 capital ships. Except that the Terran Commonwealth was building 24 capital ships a year, and the Alliance produced 10. At that, the Alliance was at a full war footing, pressing every sinew of its member systems industry to produce starships and starfighters. The Commonwealth wasn't. The Terrans were fighting a two-front war and dealing with half a dozen minor revolts or resistance movements and winning on what was still basically a peacetime production schedule. For whatever reason, they'd focused their efforts over the last year on the Stellar League, the third party the Alliance had dragged into war with the Commonwealth, but they could change that on a dime. If half of the fleet deployed against the League was redeployed against the Alliance, it was over.
"What do we do, sir?"
Sterling asked. He was looking at the display and had to be running through the same analysis Kyle was. Gods knew they'd gone over it in private and in meetings and conferences enough. "In 4 hours, I walk into a conference with the political and military leaders of the Alliance and tell them we can't win this war the way we've been fighting it." Kyle smiled sadly at the city behind the disheartening display. "And then I tell them all of the horrifying ways we might be able to win anyway." Kyle and Sterling stepped into the auditorium being prepared for the presentation, the Federation Marines standing guard checking their implant IDs without even needing to break their step. The auditorium space was buried 76 stories underground. To even reach this floor, the two Federation officers had passed through 14 different layers of security. And yet, if their implant IDs hadn't been cleared for this room, the power-armored Marines would have detained them immediately. The room wasn't large enough to hold every member of the meeting, but holo projectors covered every available surface. Once active, the room would artificially expand to hold the dozens of senior flag officers and heads of state that Kyle was going to be presenting to. It was large enough to hold all 40-odd members of the Joint Strategic Options Command, a collection of the most off-the-wall tacticians, mavericks, and generally effective pains in the ass that the Alliance had to its name, commanded by Kyle himself. Those officers weren't going to be saying much today, but they drafted the four options that Kyle had to present. Two non-JSOC officers were also waiting in the room, and Kyle saluted crisply as he realized he was the last to arrive of the three flag officers who would be physically present.
"Are you ready?"
Admiral Mohammed Kane, chief of personnel for the Castle Federation Space Navy, asked him. Kane was a tall man, skin pale from years of indoor and spaceborne work assembling the edifice of living bodies that kept the Federation in the war, clad in a black Navy uniform and matching turban. "What's to be ready for?" Kyle asked with a bright grin. "All I have to do is convince the leaders of over a dozen star nations and their top flag officers that my own brand of calculated hyper-aggression is the only way we're going to win this war. It'll be easy." The third flag officer chuckled and shook her graying head repressively at him. Fleet Admiral Meredith Blake was the Federation's chief of naval operations and the head of the Alliance Joint Chiefs. No single person was more responsible for the prosecution of the war against the Terran Commonwealth than she, and it had aged her decades in years. "You, Admiral Roberts, can fool your minions," she told him. "You can fool your fellows. You can, even, Stars hoping, fool the Senate and our allies.
But you have never fooled me.
Kyle inclined his head in acknowledgement of her point. None of our options are good, he admitted. But if Walking Stick has taken Midori, he's already begun his next offensive. We don't know where he'll strike next, but he's already demonstrated that this time he's prepared to go head-on at our largest concentrations. We need to get ahead of the curve, make the Commonwealth dance to our tune, or it's all over, bar the dying. Blake nodded her agreement.
I think I liked it better when he was being cheerful,
Kane told the CNO.
Are we sure we can sell the Senate on any of this?
Even if Kyle sold the rest of the Alliance on his plans, the 13-person executive of the Castle Federation would decide if the Federation Navy was involved in carrying them out, and without the CFSN, none of the possible operations would work.
We've run the numbers, Kyle told the two flag officers, pitching his voice so none of the surrounding junior officers could hear him. 18 more months, plus or minus 6.
The head of the Joint Department of Personnel winced.
How do you manage to be cheerful? He asked.
Practice, Kyle told him, the bright grin returning to his face as he controlled his fear. Lots and lots of practice. He checked the time in his implant. We're on. Chapter 4. Castle System. 2200, August 1st, 2737, Earth Standard Meridian, date, time. New Cardiff. As the projectors came online and the virtual conference room expanded around Kyle, he buried the last of anything resembling stage fright as he mentally catalogued his audience. Every major leader and their top flag officers were there, linked in by the near-instantaneous connections of the QCOM networks. His own implants interfaced with the system, the virtual conference as much in his head as it was in the holograms around him, highlighting individuals he looked at and making sure he knew who they were. A faux pas today could cause all kinds of trouble. Closest to him were the 13 men and women of the Castle Federation Senate, a co-equal executive that controlled the 17 star systems of his own home nation. Central in their ranks was the mask-like face of Senator Joseph Randall, the senator for Castle and unchallenged first among equals of the Senate. He was also a man who had repeatedly tried to have Kyle killed and, relatedly, whose son remained in a Federation penitentiary for treason. Next was the pale and dark-haired Imperator of the Coraline Imperium, John von Coral. Still looking surprisingly young for his authority, von Coral was the unquestioned ruler of the Imperium, and single-handedly directed the might of the Alliance's second most powerful nation. In many ways, von Coral was the man Kyle needed to convince the most. Fortunately, they'd met, and he trusted the younger man's judgment. Sky Marshal Octavian von Stenger sat carefully next to his Imperator, the bald leader of the Imperium's military, looking like he'd swallowed a raw lemon. Like the rest of the Alliance chiefs of staff, he'd been briefed on what JSOC was here to present. And like JSOC themselves, he didn't like it. The list of names of import went on and on. Queen Victoria II of the Star Kingdom of Phoenix and her Prime Minister. Hanna Kovachev, the pudgy transhuman chairman of the Renaissance Trade Factor Board. 2 dozen heads of smaller, single-system governments. The Alliance of Free Stars was made up of 65 star systems, collected into 32 nations. With the fall of Midori, 6 of those nations and 7 of those star systems were now occupied by the Terran Commonwealth. Every unoccupied nation was represented here. Their leaders gathered to hear what Rear Admiral Kyle Roberts' research group had pulled together. As he told Kane, however, he'd put a lot of practice into not merely projecting a bright cheer in any circumstances, but in actually being cheerful in the face of almost any challenge. Ladies, gentlemen, officers, and representatives, Admiral Blake greeted the gathering crowd. My systems show that we have everyone present that was invited, except the President of Midori. There was a rumble of concern. Thatcher was successfully evacuated aboard Midori's Hope and is in transit with the rest of Task Force to join 7th Fleet, Blake continued. While we could probably loop him in,
He is understandably exhausted. We'll provide him and his government in exile a recording of Admiral Roberts' presentation later, but he will not be joining us tonight.
The rumble died down, but Kyle knew the undercurrent remained. A year earlier, a series of offensives had reclaimed all of the captured systems and enabled follow-through operations that had struck into Commonwealth space. Now, over the last 6 months, 7 systems had been lost. Different systems from before. The Alliance's morale was wavering, and everyone in this room was expecting JSOC to provide a miracle.
"You have all been briefed on the mandate of the Joint Strategic Options Command," the Admiral noted. "We have provided them with complete access to all of our intelligence across the board. I think Admiral Roberts knows more of what's going on right now than I do. And their task was to find a way to win this war. To present their conclusions, I yield the floor to Rear Admiral Kyle Roberts, the Stellar Fox."
Kyle smiled and bowed his head to his boss. He might have grown used to the nickname, but that didn't mean he liked it. "Officers, representatives," he greeted them as he stepped into the center of the auditorium. "We all know who the others are, so I think I will get directly to the point." A thought through his implant triggered a simplified version of the chart in his office, showing losses across the last 6 months. "Let me begin with what has to be said, what we must all understand for this presentation to be relevant, and what I know everyone in this room suspects, even if few of us have dared to say it out loud. The Alliance is losing this war." Kyle waited out the mix of angry, surprised, and disappointed responses, judging the hubbub carefully before raising his hands and cutting everyone off.
"Everyone in this meeting has been fully briefed on our situation," he reminded them. "We started this war with 290 active-duty ships and 80 ships in reserves. We have barely 250 ships left. And over 2 years, we've commissioned 60 new warships. Over 130 starships have been lost in action, 20,000 starfighters, 87 manned defensive platforms." He let the numbers sink in. "Putting aside the Kamadian massacre, we have lost over 200,000 spacers and soldiers in the space of 2 years." He hated the fact that that number was the least important. The Federation alone had over 40 billion citizens. Even with barely 8% of the population qualifying to be starship crew and less than 1% qualifying for starfighter service, the Alliance could replace its personnel losses easily. What they could not do was magically increase the production of the massive exotic matter coils required for Alcubierre Stetson FTL drives. "We are accelerating our construction dramatically," he noted. 10 ships this year, 15 next year. He knew the numbers by heart now. "We have reached the point where we are crippling our production of civilian shipping to provide AS for warships. Part of JSOC's job was to run the economic numbers, so we did." Another mental command opened a map of Alliance space, with a number of bright green markers. "Each of these markers is an exotic matter production facility of sufficient scale to produce AS coils," he said quietly. "In the entire Alliance, there are only 34 such facilities. Each is capable of growing 4 starship-grade exotic matter coils a year. Enough for 1 civilian ship or 2/3 of a warship's needs. We will have no new facilities of this scale for at least 3 years," Kyle warned them all. "That means that even if we completely shut down civilian starship construction, we cannot build more than 22 ships a year."
"The Commonwealth has taken their own losses," Senator Randall objected. "Worse losses."
"Yes," Kyle agreed with the senator, despite the fact that the audience wasn't supposed to be heckling him yet. "The Commonwealth initially equipped Marshal Walkingstick with a fleet of 110 capital ships, plus 15 Q-ships. To all intents and purposes, that fleet has been destroyed. He has been reinforced continuously throughout this war,
leaving him with a current estimated strength of approximately 120 warships. He has lost roughly equal numbers of ships to the Alliance, representing basically 100% losses from his original fleet. Prior to the beginning of the war with the Stellar League, he was slated to be reinforced with a single lump of an additional 120 warships, concentrating 30% of the Commonwealth's fleet into his Rimward March's command, and allowing him to simply run right over us. Almost a year later, Kyle still had twinges of guilt over dragging the League into the war. The Commonwealth's determination to reunify humanity had meant war between them and the League was inevitable. But the false flag operation that had triggered it still sat poorly with him. Instead, the Commonwealth now finds itself in a two-front war. Their own internal politics mean a minimum of 50% of their fleet is locked down in either defensive or suppressive formations inside their own borders. That leaves them with a mere 300 starships for deployable strength, and an annual production of 24 starships. Kyle grimaced. That, to be clear, is still a functionally peacetime production schedule, he reminded his audience. An equivalent effort to our current projects would double that. An all-out war industry in the Commonwealth could easily produce 60 starships a year. A starship is a 3-year project, so it would take them time to ramp up to that. Time the existing 600 warships of the Terran Commonwealth Navy would easily buy them if they were truly threatened. He shook his head. You all know this, he reminded them again. We have whispered it in back hallways and thought it in the quiet of our minds, but we must confront the reality. So far we have fought a conventional war against the Commonwealth and held our own, but we cannot win a conventional war. With a wave of his hand, he disappeared the displays and faced his audience. Confront that, he told them. Accept that. We at JSOC had to do that months ago. You asked us to do the impossible. Find a way to win this war.
You just said we couldn't, someone objected.
Kyle could have learned who, but he didn't need to. He smiled toothily.
I said we cannot win a conventional war, he echoed. But that, officers and representatives, is why you gave me all of your worst mavericks and most unconventional tacticians. It was JSOC's job to find a way to end the war. After 6 months, we have four options. Which one the Alliance will act on is a political decision, but I warn you now, we must act. He waited for the audience to quiet. There were a lot of important people in the room, but it didn't take as long as he'd feared. They were all aware just how many other important people's time they were wasting. I'd ask that you refrain from questions or comments until I have listed all four possible options, Kyle told them. All of them will be controversial, and this is not a decision I would expect to make in a few minutes, or even a few hours. He paused, giving them a moment to raise any preliminary questions, and then squared his shoulders and faced the cameras and his audience as steadily as he could. The first option is the one we all hate, he told them. While we are reasonably certain that we cannot win the war, we remain in a position to inflict massive damage and casualties on the Commonwealth, not to mention the costs to ourselves to continue prosecuting the war. We represent the third largest grouping of human worlds in existence, and the largest is at war with the second largest as well. If we request a ceasefire to negotiate the terms of our absorption into the Commonwealth, it will be granted, he said softly. Peaceful annexation would inevitably include the transfer of our ships, potentially with crews intact, to the Commonwealth. If we surrender, he used the word with careful intent, we doom the Stellar League as well. The unificationists in the Commonwealth claim that the course of history is inevitable, that all of mankind will be unified. If we join the Commonwealth, that becomes inarguable. The League would go from outnumbered 2-1 to 3-1, and that war would be over within months. Combined,
The new Commonwealth birthed from our concession would represent 62% of human-occupied space and 76% of known human populations. Despite his request to wait to comment, there were shouts and questions. He ignored them, but he let them die down before he continued. "On the other hand," he told them, "we are at a point where we can negotiate extremely favorable terms for our member worlds. The surrender of our fleets would be bought with cash and technological subsidies the like of which have never been seen before. While our multistellar governments would be dissolved, our worlds and our people would be far better off than if they were forcefully annexed." Much as he hated to even think it, Kyle had run the numbers. Even purely from the perspective of the Alliance worlds, surrendering to the Commonwealth had the biggest upsides. From a cold-blooded, greatest good for the greatest number of people perspective, their concession would benefit them, the Commonwealth, and even the Stellar League, which would trade a long, grinding war for a swift, crushing defeat. "We would represent just over 25% of the Commonwealth's population after annexation," he said quietly. "A political and economic bloc that could not be disrespected. But the nations everyone in this room is sworn to serve and defend would cease to exist. The people we swore to serve and defend would survive, but only at the price of our sovereignty, nationhood, and unique identities." Kyle smiled. "But that is a way to end the war," he noted, "and you charged me and my fellows to win the war. Towards that objective, we have designed three operations plans that we believe can win the war in under a year. None of these plans are clean," he warned, the last of his customary cheer fading. "If we sign off on any of them, there will be more blood on our hands than any Alliance leadership before us. Some of these ops plans will make the Kamatian massacre look like a tea party and will render us galactic pariahs. But they will win us the war, if we are prepared to pay the price." Now Kyle had everyone's attention. JSOC had been made up of problem cases, mavericks, officers who no one liked being in command of but who got results. They were the type of officers whose commanders believed they could see an unconventional end to the war. "The three operations plans are designated Dragon, Hydra, and Medusa," he told them. "The names don't tell you much, but I must make clear that we only have the resources to execute one of them. Each will require us to take immense risks in exchange for potential immense reward. Operation Dragon is total war," Kyle noted first. He brought up a strategic display of the Commonwealth's core and highlighted Sol. "Analysis of the Commonwealth's old worlds, based on several classified covert operations, suggests that they are not as well defended as we are used to thinking," he told them. "The starfighter complements are modern, but the defensive forces are otherwise equipped with older gear. Most of the fixed defenses are, frankly, garbage, and the starship commands do not expect an attack. While they are well defended, they are not invulnerable," Kyle concluded. "Operation Dragon calls for us to assemble a force of approximately 100 capital ships and punch directly for Sol. Secondary forces, totaling another 60 to 80 ships, will accompany the main fleet to carry out harassing strikes on the other older worlds, keeping the Commonwealth Navy off balance." He paused to let the sheer audacity of the concept sink in. "The fleets will need to steal Commonwealth supplies along the way," he noted, highlighting four systems. "These four systems are major rear-area supply depots. Two are otherwise uninhabited. None are heavily defended. A single carrier should be able to seize each system and neutralize communications before the main force moves in. That will allow us to reach Sol with the advantage of surprise. The Dragon fleet will then secure the Sol system and take control of Earth's upper orbitals, at which point they will demand the surrender of the Commonwealth." His audience was silent. "What must be understood before embarking on Operation Dragon is that the Commonwealth Senate will almost certainly not surrender simply because we have occupied Seoul. The fleet must be authorized to carry out demonstration nuclear and antimatter strikes on civilian targets and sent out with the understanding that those strikes will be done. We assess the likelihood that it will be necessary to functionally destroy Earth